The Soldier's Tale, The War Lovers. It was during the Battle of Agincourt that Phedmon Cassad encountered the woman he would spend the rest of his life seeking. It was a wet and chilly late October morning in AD 1415. Cassad had been inserted as an archer into the army of Henry V of England. The English force had been on French soil since August 14th. And had been retreating from superior French forces since October 8th. Henry had convinced his war council that the army could beat the French in a forced march to the safety of Calais. They had failed. Now, as October 25th dawned gray and drizzly, 7,000 Englishmen, mostly bowmen, faced a force of some 28,000 French men-at-arms across a kilometer of muddy field. Cassad was cold, tired, sick, and scared. He and the other archers had been surviving on little more than scavenged berries for the past week of the march, and almost every man on the line that morning was suffering from diarrhea. The air temperature was in the low 50s Fahrenheit, and Cassad had spent a long night trying to sleep on damp ground. He was impressed with the unbelievable realism of the experience. The Olympus Command School Historical Tactical Network was as far beyond regular stim-sims as full-form hollows were beyond tintypes. But the physical sensations were so convincing, so real, that Cassad did not relish the thought of being wounded. There were tales of cadets receiving fatal wounds in the OCS-HTN sims and being pulled dead from their immersion creches. Cassad and the other bowmen on Henry's right flank had been staring at the larger French force for most of the morning when pennants waved, the 15th century equivalent of sergeant's braid, and the archers obeyed the king's command and began marching against the enemy. The ragged English line, stretching about 700 meters across the field from tree line to tree line, consisted of clusters of archers like Cassad's troop interspersed with smaller groups of men-at-arms. The English had no formal cavalry, and most of the horses Cassad could see on his end of the field were carrying men clustered near the king's command group, 300 meters toward the center, or huddled around the Duke of York's position much closer to where Cassad and the other archers stood near the right flank. These command groups reminded Cassad of a force ground mobile staff HQ, only instead of the inevitable forest of comm antennae giving away their position, bright banners and pennants hung limp on pikes. An obvious artillery target, thought Cassad, and then reminded himself that this particular military nuance did not yet exist. Cassad noticed that the French had plenty of horses. He estimated 600 or 700 mounted men formed in ranks on each side of the French flanks and a long line of cavalry behind the main battle line. Cassad did not like horses. He had seen hollows and pictures, of course, but he had not encountered the animals themselves until this exercise, and the size, smell, and sound of them tended to be unnerving. Especially so when the damn quadrupeds were armored chest and head, shod in steel, and trained to carry armored men wielding 4 meters of lance. The English advance halted. Cassad estimated that his battle line was about 250 meters from the French. He knew from the experience of the past week that this was within longbow range, but he also knew that he would have to pull his arm half out of its socket to hold the pull. The French were shouting what Cassad assumed were insults. He ignored them as he and his silent comrades stepped forward from where they had planted their long arrows and found soft ground in which to drive their stakes. The stakes were long and heavy, and Cassad had been carrying his for a week. Almost a meter and a half long, the clumsy thing had been sharpened at both ends. When the order first came down for all the archers to find saplings and cut stakes somewhere in the deep woods just after they had crossed the Somme, Cassad had wondered idly what the things were for. Now he knew. Every third archer carried a heavy mallet, and now they took turns driving their stakes in at a careful angle. Cassad pulled out his long knife, resharpened the end which, even leaning, rose almost to his chest, and stepped back through the hedgehog of sharpened stakes to await the French charge. The French did not charge. Cassad waited with the others. His bow was strung, 48 arrows were planted in 2 clusters at his feet, and his feet were set properly. The French did not charge. The rain had stopped, but a cool breeze had come up, and what little body heat Cassad had generated by the short march and the task of driving stakes had been lost quickly. The only sounds were the metallic shufflings of men and horses, occasional mutterings or nervous laughs, and the heavier thud of hooves as the French cavalry rearranged itself but still refused to charge.
"Fuck this," said a grizzled yeoman a few feet from Cassad. "Those bastards have wasted our whole bleeding morning. They'd better piss or get off the pot."
Cassad nodded. He was not sure if he was hearing and understanding Middle English, or if the sentence had been in simple standard. He had no idea if the grizzled archer was another command school cadet, an instructor, or merely an artifact of the Sim. He could not guess if the slang had been correct. He did not care. His heart was pounding, and his palms were sweaty. He wiped his hands on his jerkin. As if King Henry had taken his cue from the old man's muttering, command flags suddenly bobbed and rose, sergeants screamed, and row upon row of English archers raised their longbows, pulled when commands were shouted, released on the next command. 4 waves of arrows comprised of more than 6,000-meter-long, chisel-pointed, cloth-yard missiles rose, seemed to hang in a cloud 30 meters up, and fell on the French. There came the sound of horses screaming, and 1,000 demented children pounding on 10,000 tin pots as the French men-at-arms leaned into the rain of arrows to let their steel helmets and their chest and shoulder armor take the brunt of the downpour. Cassad knew that in military terms little real damage had been done. But this was small solace to the occasional French soldier with 10 inches of arrow through his eye, or to the scores of horses leaping, tumbling, and crashing into one another while their riders struggled to remove wooden shafts from the creatures' backs and flanks. The French did not charge. More commands were shouted. Cassad raised, readied, loosed his arrow, again and again. The sky darkened every 10 seconds. Cassad's arm and back ached from the punishing rhythm. He found that he felt neither elation nor anger. He was doing his job. His forearm was raw. Again the arrows flew, and again. 15 of his first sheaf of 24 arrows were gone, when a cry went up along the English line, and Cassad paused and glanced down while holding full pull. The French were charging. A cavalry charge was something beyond Cassad's experience. Watching 1,200 armored horses charging directly at him created internal sensations which Cassad found a bit unnerving. The charge took less than 40 seconds, but Cassad discovered that this was ample time for his mouth to go absolutely dry, his breathing to begin to have problems, and for his testicles to retreat completely into his body. If the rest of Cassad could have found a comparable hiding place, he would have seriously considered crawling into it. As it was, he was too busy to run. Firing on command, his line of archers got off 5 flat volleys at the attacking horsemen, managed 1 more shot in independent fire, and then they fell back 5 paces. Horses, it turned out, were too smart to willingly impale themselves upon stakes, no matter how hard their human riders implored them to do so. But the 2nd and 3rd waves of cavalry did not stop as abruptly as the first. And, in a single mad moment, horses were down and screaming, riders were thrown and screaming, and Cassad was out and screaming, rushing at every downed Frenchman he could see, wielding a mallet on the prostrate form when he could, slashing through gaps in armor with his long knife when it was too crowded to swing the mallet. Soon, he and the grizzled archer and a younger man who had lost his cap became an efficient killing team, closing in on a downed rider from 3 sides, Cassad using the mallet to knock the pleading horseman off his knees, then all 3 moving in with their blades. Only one knight gained his feet and raised a sword to confront them. The Frenchman flipped up his visor and called out a clear request for honor and single combat. The old man and the youth circled like wolves. Cassad returned with his bow and put an arrow into the knight's left eye from 10 paces. The battle continued in the deadly comic opera vein common to all armed combat since the first rock and thigh-bone duels on old Earth. The French cavalry managed to turn and flee just as the first wave of 10,000 men-at-arms charged the English center on foot. The melee broke up the rhythm of the attack, and by the time the French had regained their initiative, Henry's own men-at-arms had braced to hold them at pike length, while Cassad and several thousand other archers poured volley fire into the massed French infantry at close range. That did not end the battle. It was not necessarily even the decisive moment. The turning point, when it came, was lost, as all such moments are, within the dust and turmoil of 1,000 individual encounters where infantrymen faced infantrymen across the distance of their personal weapons. Before it was over, some 3 hours later, there would be minor variations on repeated themes, ineffective thrusts and clumsy counter-thrusts, and a less than honorable moment when Henry would order prisoners killed rather than leave them in the rear when the English were confronted with a new threat. But the heralds and historians would later agree that the outcome had been sealed somewhere in the confusion during the first French infantry charge. The French died in the thousands. English dominion on that part of the continent would continue for a while. The day of the armored man-at-arms, the knight, the embodiment of chivalry, was over, hammered into history's coffin by a few thousand ragtag peasant archers carrying longbows. The ultimate insult to the noble-born French dead, if the dead indeed could be further insulted, lay in the fact that the English archers were not only common men, common in the lowest, most flea-infested sense of the word, but that they were draftees, doughboys, GIs, grunts, AIPs, spezzes, K-Techs, jump rats. But all that was in the lesson Cassad was supposed to have learned during that OCS-HTN exercise. He learned none of it. He was too busy having an encounter which would change his life. The French man-at-arms went over the head of his falling horse, rolled once, and was up and running for the woods before the mud quit flying. Cassad followed. He was halfway to the tree line before he realized that the youth and the grizzled archer had not come with him. It did not matter. Cassad's adrenaline was flowing, and the bloodlust had him in its grip. The man-at-arms, who had just been thrown to the ground from a horse moving at full gallop, and who was wearing 60 pounds of clumsy armor, should have been an easy prey to catch. He was not. The Frenchman glanced back once, saw Cassad coming on a full run with a mallet in his hand and his eye full of business, and then the man-at-arms shifted into a higher gear and reached the trees 15 meters ahead of his pursuer. Cassad was deep into the woods before he stopped, leaned on the mallet, gasped, and considered his position. Thuds, screams, and crashes from the battlefield behind him were muffled by distance and shrubbery. The trees were almost bare and still dripped from the rainstorm the night before. The floor of the forest was carpeted with a thick layer of old leaves and a snarl of shrubs and brambles. The man-at-arms had left a trail of broken branches and footsteps for the first 20 meters or so, but now deer trails and overgrown paths made it difficult to see where he had passed. Cassad moved slowly, stepping deeper into the woods, trying to be alert for any noise above the sound of his own panting and the insane pounding of his heart. It occurred to Cassad that, tactically speaking, this was not a brilliant move. The man-at-arms had been wearing full armor and carrying his sword when he disappeared in the bushes. At any moment, the Frenchman might forget his panic, regret his temporary loss of honor, and remember his years of combat training. Cassad had also been trained. He looked down at his cloth shirt and leather vest. The mallet was still in his hands, the knife in his broad belt. He had been trained to use high-energy weapons with a killing range of a few meters to thousands of kilometers. He had been rated in plasma grenades, hell whips, flechette rifles, sonics, recoilless zero-gravity weapons, death wands, kinetic assault guns, and beam gauntlets. He now had a working knowledge of an English longbow. None of these objects, including the longbow, was on his person at the moment. "Ah, shit," murmured Second Lieutenant Cassad. The man-at-arms came out of the bushes like a charging bear, arms up, legs apart, the sword coming around in a flat arc meant to disembowel Cassad. The OCS cadet tried to leap back and raise his mallet at the same time. Neither effort was completely successful. The Frenchman's sword knocked the heavy mallet out of Cassad's grip, while the dull point of the blade slashed through leather, shirt, and skin. Cassad bellowed and stumbled backward again, tugging at the knife in his belt. His right heel caught the branch of a fallen tree, and he went down backward, cursing and rolling deeper into the tangle of branches as the man-at-arms crashed forward, his heavy sword clearing limbs like an oversized machete. Cassad had his knife out by the time the man-at-arms had cleared a path through the deadfall, but the 10-inch blade was a pitiful thing against armor, unless the knight was helpless. This knight was not helpless. Cassad knew that he would never get inside the arc of swordblade. His only hope was in running. But the tall trunk of the fallen tree behind him and the deadfall beyond eliminated that option. He did not wish to get cut down from behind as he turned, nor from below as he climbed. Cassad did not wish to be cut down from any angle. Cassad went into a knife fighter's crouch, which he hadn't used since his street fighting days in the Tharsis slums. He wondered how the simulation would deal with his death. The figure appeared behind the man-at-arms like a sudden shadow. The noise of Cassad's mallet striking the knight's armored shoulder sounded precisely like someone bashing the hood of an EMV with a sledgehammer. The Frenchman staggered, turned to meet the new threat, and took a second mallet blow in the chest. Cassad's savior was small. The man-at-arms did not go down. The French knight was raising his sword above his head when Cassad hit him behind and below the knees with a shoulder tackle. Tree limbs snapped as the Frenchman went down. The small attacker stood astride the knight, pinning the armored man's sword arm with one foot, while bringing the mallet down repeatedly onto helmet and visor. Cassad extricated himself from the tangle of legs and branches, sat on the downed man's knees, and began slashing through gaps in armor at groin, sides, and underarms. Cassad's rescuer jumped aside to plant both feet on the knight's wrist, and Cassad scrambled forward, stabbing through crevices where the helmet met chest armor, finally slamming the blade through slits in the visor itself. The knight screamed as the mallet came down a final time, almost catching Cassad's hand as the hammer drove the blade through the visor slit like a 10-inch tent peg. The man-at-arms arched, lifting Cassad and 60 pounds of armor clear of the ground in a final violent spasm, and then fell back, limply. Cassad rolled onto his side. His rescuer collapsed beside him. Both were covered with sweat and the dead man's blood. Cassad looked at his savior. The woman was tall and dressed in clothes not dissimilar to Cassad's. For a moment, they merely lay there and gasped for air.
"Are you all right?"
Cassad managed after a while. He was suddenly struck by her appearance. Her brown hair was short by current World Web fashion. Short and straight, and cut so that the longest strands fell from the part just a few centimeters left of the center of her forehead to just above her right ear. It was a boy's haircut from some forgotten time. But she was no boy. Cassad thought that she was perhaps the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. Bone structure so perfect that chin and cheekbones were shaped without being too sharp. large eyes glowing with life and intelligence, a gentle mouth with a soft underlip. Lying next to her, Kassad realized that she was tall, not so tall as he, but obviously not a woman from the 15th century. And even under her loose tunic and baggy trousers, he could see the soft swell of hips and breast. She appeared to be a few years older than Kassad, perhaps in her late 20s. But this fact barely registered as she continued staring into his face with those soft, beguiling, endlessly deep eyes.
"Are you all right?"
he asked again. His voice sounded strange even to himself. She did not answer. Or, rather, she answered by sliding long fingers across Kassad's chest, ripping away the leather thongs which bound the rough vest. Her hands found his shirt. It was soaked with blood and ripped halfway down the front. The woman ripped it open the rest of the way. She moved against him now, her fingers and lips on his chest, hips already beginning to move. Her right hand found the cords to his trouser front, ripped them free. Kassad helped her pull off the rest of his clothes, removed hers with three fluid movements. She wore nothing under her shirt and coarse cloth trousers. Kassad's hand slid between her thighs, behind her, cupped her moving buttocks, pulled her closer, and slid to the moist roughness in front. She opened to him, her mouth closing on his. Somehow, with all of their motion and disrobing, their skin never lost contact. Kassad felt his own excitement rubbing against the cusp of her belly. She rolled above him then, her thighs astride his hips, her gaze still locked with his. Kassad had never been so excited. He gasped as her right hand went behind her, found him, guided him into her. When he opened his eyes again, she was moving slowly, her head back, eyes closed. Kassad's hands moved up her sides to cup her perfect breasts, nipples hardened against his palms. They made love then. Kassad, at 23 standard years, had been in love once and had enjoyed sex many times. He thought he knew the way and the why of it. There was nothing in his experience to that moment which he could not have described with a phrase and a laugh to his squad mates in the hold of a troop transport. With the calm, sure cynicism of a 23-year-old veteran, he was sure that he would never experience anything that could not be so described, so dismissed. He was wrong. He could never adequately share the sense of the next few minutes with anyone else. He would never try. They made love in a sudden shaft of late October light, with a carpet of leaves and clothes beneath them, and a film of blood and sweat oiling the sweet friction between them. Her green eyes stared down at Kassad, widening slightly when he began moving quickly, closing at the same second he closed his. They moved together then in the sudden tide of sensation, as old and inevitable as the movement of worlds, pulses racing, flesh quickening with its own moist purposes, a further, final rising together, the world receding to nothing at all. And then, still joined by touch and heartbeat and the fading thrill of passion, allowing consciousness to slide back to separate flesh, while the world flowed in through forgotten senses. They lay next to each other. The dead man's armor was cold against Kassad's left arm, her thigh warm against his right leg. The sunlight was a benediction. Hidden colors rose to the surface of things. Kassad turned his head and gazed at her as she rested her head on his shoulder. Her cheeks glowed with flush and autumn light, and her hair lay like copper threads along the flesh of his arm. She curved her leg over his thigh, and Kassad felt the clockwise stirring of renewed passion. The sun was warm on his face. He closed his eyes. When he awoke, she was gone. He was certain that only seconds had passed, No more than a minute, certainly. But the sunlight was gone. Colors had flowed out of the forest, and a cool evening breeze moved bare branches. Kassad, dressed in torn clothes made stiff with blood. The French man-at-arms lay still and rigid in the unself-conscious attitude of death. He already seemed inanimate, a part of the forest. There was no sign whatsoever of the woman. Fedmon Kassad limped his way back through the woods, evening gloom, and a sudden, chilling drizzle. The battlefield still held people, living and dead. The dead lay in heaps like the piles of toy soldiers Kassad had played with as a child. Wounded men moved slowly with the help of friends. Here and there, furtive forms picked their way among the dead, and near the opposite tree line, a lively group of heralds, both French and English, met in conclave with much pointing and animated conversation. Kassad knew that they had to decide upon a name for the battle, so that their respective records would agree. He also knew that they would settle on the name of the nearest castle, Agincourt, even though it had figured in neither strategy nor battle. Kassad was beginning to think that this was no simulation, that his life in the world web was the dream, and that this gray day had to be reality. When suddenly, the entire scene froze with outlines of human figures, horses, and the darkening forest becoming as transparent as a fading hollow. And then, Kassad was being helped out of his simulation creche at the Olympus Command School, and the other cadets and instructors were rising, talking, laughing with one another, all seemingly unaware that the world had changed forever. For weeks, Kassad spent every free hour wandering the command school grounds, watching from the ramparts as the evening shadow of Mons Olympus covered first the plateau forest, then the heavily settled highlands, then everything halfway to the horizon, and then all the world. And every second he thought about what had happened. He thought about her. No one else had noticed anything strange in the simulation. No one else had left the battlefield. One instructor explained that nothing beyond the battlefield existed in that particular segment of the simulation. No one had missed Kassad. It was as if the incident in the forest and the woman had never happened. Kassad knew better. He attended his classes on military history and mathematics. He put in his hours at the firing range and gym. He walked off barracks punishments on the Caldera Quadrangle, although these were rare. In general, young Kassad became an even more excellent officer cadet than he had been. But all the while, he waited. And then, she came again. Again, it was in the final hours of an OSCHTN simulation. By then, Kassad had learned that the exercises were something more than mere simulations. The OCSHTN was part of the World Web All Thing, the real-time network which governed hegemony politics, fed information to tens of billions of data-hungry citizens, and had evolved a form of autonomy and consciousness all its own. More than 150 planetary dataspheres mingled their resources within the framework created by 6,000 Omega-class AIs to allow the OCSHTN to function.
"The HTN stuff doesn't simulate," whined Cadet Radinsky, the best AI expert Kassad could find and bribe to explain. "It dreams. Dreams with the best historical accuracy in the web, way beyond the sum of its parts. 'Cause it plugs in holistic insight as well as facts, and when it dreams, it lets us dream with it."
Kassad had not understood, but he had believed. And then, she came again. In the first U.S.-Vietnam War, they made love in the aftermath of an ambush during the darkness and terror of a night patrol. Kassad wore rough camouflage clothes, with no underwear because of the jungle crotch rot, and a steel helmet not much more advanced than those at Agincourt. She wore black pajamas and sandals, the universal garb of the Southeast Asian peasant. and the Viet Cong. Then neither of them wore anything as they made love standing in the night, her back against a tree, and her legs wrapped around him, while beyond them the world exploded in the green glow of perimeter flares and the sputter crack of claymores. She came to him on the second day of Gettysburg and again at Borodino, where the clouds of powder smoke hung above the piles of bodies like a vapor congealed from departing souls. They made love in the shattered hulk of an APC in Hellas Basin, while the hover tank battle still raged and the red dust of the approaching simoon scraped and shrieked at the titanium hull.
"Tell me your name," he had whispered in standard. She shook her head. "Are you real, outside the simulation?"
he asked in the Japanese English of that era. She had nodded and leaned closer to kiss him. They lay together in a sheltered place among the ruins of Brasilia, while death beams from Chinese EMVs played like blue searchlights on broken ceramic walls. During an unnamed battle after a siege of a forgotten tower city on the Russian steppes, he pulled her back into the shattered room where they had made love, and he whispered,
"I want to stay with you."
She touched his lips with a finger and shook her head. After the evacuation of New Chicago, as they lay on the 100th floor balcony, where Kassad had set his sniper's nest for the last U.S. president's hopeless rearguard action, he placed his hand on the warm flesh between her breasts and said,
"Can you ever join me? Out there?"
She touched his cheek with her palm and smiled. During the last year in command school, there were only 5 OCS HTN sims as the cadets' training shifted to live field exercises. Sometimes, as when Kassad was strapped into the tactical command chair during a battalion-sized drop onto Ceres, he closed his eyes, looked between the primary colored geographies of the cortically generated tactical terrain matrix, and felt a sense of someone? Of her? He was not sure. And then she did not come again. Not in the final months of work, not in the final simulation of the great coal sack battle where General Horace Glennon Height's mutiny was defeated, not during the parades and parties of graduation, nor as the class marched in a final Olympian review before the hegemony CEO, saluting from his red-lit levitation deck. And there was no time even for dreaming as the young officers farcast to Earth's moon for the Masada ceremony, farcast again to Tau Ceti Center for their formal swearing-in to force, and then they were finished. Second Lieutenant Cadet Kassad became Lieutenant Kassad, spent 3 standard weeks free in the web with a force-issued universal card, which allowed him to farcast as far and as frequently as he wished, and then he was shipped out to the Hegemony Colonial Service Training School on Lussis to prepare for active duty beyond the web. He was sure that he would never see her again. He was wrong. Fed Moncassad had grown up in a culture of poverty and sudden death. As a member of the minority who still called themselves Palestinians, he and his family had lived in the slums of Tharsis, human testimony to the bitter legacy of the terminally dispossessed. Every Palestinian in the world web and beyond carried the cultural memory of a century of struggle capped by a month of nationalist triumph before the nuclear jihad of 2038 wiped it all away. Then came their second diaspora, this one lasting 5 centuries and leading to dead-end desert worlds like Mars, their dream buried with the death of old Earth. Kassad, like the other boys of the South Tharsis relocation camps, either ran with gangs or faced the option of being prey to every self-proclaimed predator in the camps. He chose to run with the gangs. Kassad had killed another youth by the time he was 16 standard years old. If Mars was known for anything in the world web, it was for hunting in the Mariner Valley, Schrauder's Zen Massif in Hellas Basin, and the Olympus Command School. Kassad did not have to travel to Mariner Valley to learn about hunting and being hunted. He had no interest in Zen Gnosticism. And as a teenager, he felt nothing but contempt for the uniformed cadets who came from every part of the web to train for force. He joined with his peers in sneering at the new Bushido as a code for faggots, but an ancient vein of honor in the young Kassad's soul secretly resonated to the thought of a samurai class whose life and work revolved around duty, self-respect, and the ultimate value of one's word. When Kassad was 18, a Tharsis province higher circuit judge offered him the choice of a Martian year at polar work camp or volunteering for the John Carter Brigade, then forming to help force put down the resurgent Glennon Height Rebellion in the Class 3 colonies. Kassad volunteered and discovered that he enjoyed the discipline and cleanliness of military life, even though the John Carter Brigade saw only garrison duty within the web and was dissolved shortly after Glennon Height's cloned grandson died on Renaissance. 2 days after his 19th birthday, Kassad applied to Force Ground and was turned down. He went on a 9-day drunk, awoke in one of the deeper hive tunnels of Lussis with his military comlog implant stolen by someone who apparently had taken a correspondence course in surgery, his universal card and Farcaster access revoked, and his head exploring new frontiers of pain. Kassad worked on Lussis for a standard year, saving over 6,000 marks and allowing physical labor in the 1.3 ES gravity to put an end to his Martian frailness. By the time he used his savings to ship out to Maui Covenant on an ancient solar sail freighter with jury-rigged Hawking drives, Kassad was still lean and tall by web standards, but what muscles there were worked wonderfully well by anyone's standards. He arrived on Maui Covenant 3 days before the vicious and unpopular island war began there, and eventually, the Force Combined Commander at first sight got so tired of seeing the young Kassad waiting in his outer office that he allowed the boy to enlist in the 23rd Supply Regiment as an assistant hydrofoil driver. 11 standard months later, Corporal Fredmon Kassad of the 12th Mobile Infantry Battalion had received 2 Distinguished Service Clusters, a Senate Commendation for Valor in the Equatorial Archipelago campaign, and 2 Purple Hearts. He was also tapped for Force Command School and shipped webward on the next convoy. Kassad dreamed of her often. He had never learned her name. She had never spoken. But he could have recognized her touch and scent in total darkness among 1,000 others. He thought of her as mystery. When other young officers went whoring or seeking girlfriends in the indigenous populations, Kassad would remain on base or take long walks through strange cities. He kept his obsession with mystery secret, knowing full well how it would read on a psych report. Sometimes on bivouac under multiple moons, or in the womb-like zero-G of a troop transport hold, Kassad would realize how insane his love affair with a phantom truly was. But then, he would recall the small mole under her left breast, which he had kissed one night, feeling her heartbeat under his lips, as the ground itself shook from the firing of the big guns near Verdun. He would remember the impatient gesture with which she brushed back her hair as her cheek rested on his thigh. And the young officers would go to town or to the huts near the base, and Fedmon Kassad would read another history book or jog along the perimeter, or run tactical strategies on his comlog. It was not long before Kassad came to the attention of his superiors. During the undeclared war with the free miners in the Lambert Ring territories, it was Lieutenant Kassad who led the surviving infantry troops and marine guards in cutting through the bottom of the old asteroid bore shaft on Peregrine to evacuate the hegemony consulate staff and citizens. But it was during the short reign of the new prophet on Coom Riad that Captain Fedmon Kassad came to the attention of the entire web. The force space captain of the only hegemony ship within 2 leap years of the colony world had been paying a courtesy call when the new prophet chose to lead 30 million New Order Shiites against 2 continents of Sunni shopkeepers and 90,000 resident hegemony infidels. The ship's captain and 5 of his executive officers were taken prisoner. Urgent fatline messages from Tau Ceti Center demanded that the ranking officer aboard the orbiting HS Deneyev settle the situation on Kum Riyad, free all of the hostages, and dispose the new prophet, without resorting to the use of nuclear weapons within the planet's atmosphere. The Deneyev was an aging orbital defense picket. It carried no nuclear weapons that could be used within an atmosphere. The ranking officer on board was Force Combined Captain Fedmon Kassad. On the 3rd day of the revolution, Kassad landed the Deneyev's single assault boat in the main courtyard of the Grand Mosque at Mashhad. He and the other 34 force troopers watched as the mob grew to 300,000 militants kept at bay only by the boat's containment field and the lack of an order to attack by the new prophet. The new prophet himself was no longer in the Grand Mosque. He had flown to the northern hemisphere of Riyadh to join in the victory celebrations there. 2 hours after he landed, Captain Kassad stepped out of his ship and broadcast a short announcement. He said that he had been raised as a Muslim. He also announced that the interpretation of the Quran since the Shiites' seedship days had definitely shown that the God of Islam would neither condone nor allow the slaughter of the innocent, no matter how many jihads were proclaimed by tin-horned heretics like the new prophet. Captain Kassad gave the leaders of the 30 million zealots 3 hours to surrender their hostages and return to their homes on the desert continent of Qum. In the first 3 days of the revolution, the armies of the new prophet had occupied most of the cities on 2 continents and had taken more than 27,000 hegemony hostages. Firing squads had been busy day and night settling ancient theological disputes, and it was estimated that at least 250,000 Sunnis had been slaughtered in the first 2 days of the new prophet's occupation. In response to Kassad's ultimatum, the new prophet announced that all of the infidels would be put to death immediately following his live television address that evening. He also ordered an attack on Kassad's assault boat. Avoiding high explosives because of the Grand Mosque, the Revolutionary Guard used automatic weapons, crude energy cannon, plasma charges, and human wave attacks. The containment field held. The new prophet's televised address began 15 minutes before Kassad's ultimatum ran out. The new prophet agreed with Kassad's statement that Allah would horribly punish heretics, but announced that it was the hegemony infidels who would be so punished. It was the only time the new prophet ever had been seen to lose his temper on camera. Screaming, saliva flying, he ordered the human wave attacks to be renewed on the grounded assault boat. He announced that at that moment, 12 fission bombs were being assembled at the occupied Power for Peace reactor in Ali. With these, the forces of Allah would be carried into space itself. The first fission bomb, he explained, would be used on the infidel Kassad's satanic assault boat that very afternoon. The new prophet then began to explain exactly how the hegemony hostages would be executed. But, at that moment, Kassad's deadline ran out. Kum Riyad was, by its own choice and the accident of its distant location, a technically primitive world. But the inhabitants were not so primitive that they did not have an active datasphere. Nor were the revolutionary mullahs who had led the invasion so opposed to the great Satan of hegemony science that they refused to tie into the global data net with their personal comm logs. The HS Deneyev had seeded enough spy sats so that by 17:29 hours, Kum Riyad Central Time, the datasphere had been tapped to the point that the hegemony ship had identified 16,830 revolutionary mullahs by their access codes. At 17:29:30 hours, the spy sats began feeding their real-time targeting data to the 21 perimeter defense sats which Kassad's assault boat had left in low orbit. These orbital defense weapons were so old that the Denyev's mission had been to return them to the web for safe destruction. Kassad had suggested another use for them. At precisely 17:30 hours, 19 of the small satellites detonated their fusion cores. In the nanoseconds before their self-destruction, the resulting X-rays were focused, aimed, and released in 16,830 invisible but very coherent beams. The ancient defense sats were not designed for atmospheric use and had an effective destructive radius of less than a millimeter. Luckily, that was all that was needed. Not all of the targeting beams penetrated whatever stood between the mullahs and the sky. 15,784 did. The effect was immediate and dramatic. In each case, the target's brain and cerebral fluid boiled, turned to vapor, and blew the encasing skull to bits. The new prophet was in the middle of his live planet-wide broadcast, literally in the middle of pronouncing the word heretic, when 17:30 hours arrived. For almost 2 minutes, the TV screens and walls around the planet carried the image of the new prophet's headless body slumped over the microphone. Then, Fedman Kassad cut in on all bands to announce that his next deadline was 1 hour away and that any actions against the hostages would be met with a more dramatic demonstration of Allah's displeasure. There were no reprisals. That night, in orbit around Qum Riyad, mystery visited Kassad for the first time since his cadet days. He was asleep, but the visit was more than a dream, and less than the alternative reality of the OCS-HTN sims. The woman and he were lying together under a light blanket beneath a broken roof. Her skin was warm and electric, her face little more than a pale outline against nighttime darkness. Overhead, the stars had just begun to fade into the false light of pre-dawn. Kassad realized that she was trying to speak to him. Her soft lips formed words which were just below the threshold of Kassad's hearing. He pulled back a second in order to see her face better and, in so doing, lost contact completely. He awoke in his sleep webbing with moisture on his cheeks and the hum of the ship's systems sounding as strange to him as the breathing of some half-awakened beast. 9 standard ship weeks later, Kassad stood before a force court-martial review on Freeholm. He had known when he made his decision on Qum Riyad that his superiors would have no choice but to crucify or promote him.